Well, on August 31, it will be 20 years since Diana, Princess of Wales, died in that Paris car crash. It was the last day of the northern summer, and she became a woman whose life had no autumn and no winter. No doubt we'll see increasing mentions and commemorations of this sad milestone in the next month or two. The journalist and author Andrew Morton is marking another milestone. It's 25 years since his explosive book, Diana, Her True Story, was released, sending shockwaves through royal circles and putting on the record for the first time the true nature of the unhappy marriage between Diana and Prince Charles. The new revised edition contains 69 pages of previously unpublished transcripts of the cassette recordings Diana made secretly for Andrew Morton, pouring out her heart on almost every aspect of her life. Andrew Morton is joining us now from London. Good evening. Welcome, Andrew.
Nice to talk to you. You're absolutely right, by the way. Just by my count, there's at least 16 major documentaries being prepared for the anniversary of Diana's death.
Is that right? Yes.
Yeah. Well, it was including several in Australia, of course.
I guess it is one of those things where everyone remembers where they were. Where were you when you got the news that she'd died?
I was at the Edinburgh Arts Festival, which I go to every year, and I was woken up and by a friend who I was staying with. I raced to the airport, got one of the last seats on the plane, and kind of halfway through the flight, a guy tapped me on the shoulder, and he'd obviously recognised me. He was French, and he gave me a note saying that he'd like to apologise on behalf of the French people for what's happened. Well, at that time, and it was everybody's very raw. And at that time, you thought that Diana had obviously been chased down by wild gangs of paparazzi.
I remember at the time I had a friend who was in London, and she said it was like intruding on another family's grief. She told me about being on the tube and seeing three people sitting across from her, a young woman, an older woman and a black guy, all openly crying. It was a profound and surprising phenomenon.
Yes, it was indeed, and it obviously took the royal family by total surprise. The one thing I'd like to say about that week, though, is that many commentators kind of talk about hysteria, mass hysteria. I didn't see mass hysteria. You saw people who genuinely felt emotion and felt upset. A lot of people just quietly remembering her, putting flowers down at outside the gates at Kensington Palace. There wasn't like a wild hysteria. That's part of the effort to, as it were, bury her memory.
In what way? You mean they bury?
Well, in the sense that there's always been this kind of unspoken war between Prince Charles's side and Princess Diana's side, and the establishment would love Diana never to be mentioned again. And it just struck me that the reporting of that week always often mentions a kind of hysteria. But when you were actually there and you saw people, it was quite dignified, it was calm. It wasn't the kind of hysteria that people have talked about.
And yet perhaps her connection with William and Harry is what's going to give the monarchy an authenticity into the future that it may not otherwise have. Now, Andrew Morton, this book of yours was really controversial when it was first published 25 years ago in 1992. And it's controversial again now. This new edition has drawn some fire from a number of quarters, and we'll get on to that. But why did it eventually cause such an uproar when it first hit the bookstands?
Well, because it basically lifted the lid off the fairy tale. I mean, the Archbishop of Canterbury, when he married Charles and Diana in 1981, had talked about a fairy tale marriage. And everybody who watched that ceremony on TV bought into that. And everybody followed their lives like some kind of soap opera. And I remember when I first got a hint that all was not well, I was astonished because I was one of the royal reporters who'd gone round Australia with them in their first trip in 83, been, you know, to America, Canada, Italy and so on. And it was news to me. So for the watching world who didn't spend their lives following the royal family, it was astonishing. And so effectively, I was like the little boy who said the emperor's not wearing any clothes, that I was really telling it like it was. And in a wider sociological sense, waking Britain from its dream of monarchy.
Back in 1991, you were kind of in the right place at the right time because you happened across this guy, Dr. James Colthurst, who was working at St. Thomas's Hospital in central London. Now, he was an old family friend of Diana's, and you cultivated him. And to his surprise, Diana was a willing subject. And in fact, she wanted to talk. Remind us of how this played out and how it led to the publication of the book.
Well, I'd met James Colthurst, as you say, at St. Thomas's Hospital, and I thought he was chatty and we got on well and we played squash together, and I cultivated him as a contact, as, you know, like old-fashioned journalism, really. And at the same time, I was also cultivating other people. I'd written a book about the Duchess of York, Fergie. I was writing about the wealth of the Windsors, the Royal York Britannia. I had a little network of contacts, and I was hearing information that all was not quite well in the marriage of the Prince and Princess. Well, it's one thing to say that, but it's quite another to investigate it properly. And she knew that I was writing a biography about her. She knew that I was sympathetic towards her. And in the course of the months before we started this journey, she tested me out on several occasions. She asked me, for example, how to dismiss a hairdresser who, you know, without him going to the newspapers. So, you know, James and I suggested, well, it's pretty simple, really. We just said, you know, be nice to him, write him a nice long letter, a nice lavish gift, and send him on his way. And it worked. And then she gave me a couple of details of stories which were happening inside the royal household, and they duly made headlines. And she felt a sense of control. Because what I didn't realise at the time, what nobody realised, is that she was totally out of control. She felt desperate. And what I was doing, inadvertently, naively, if you like, was helping her to regain control of her life.
So she was trapped, you write, and she had no obvious way out of this situation. And she was right on the edge, but sort of almost, I may be saying maturing, because she was still a very young woman in 1991.
She was 30, but the worst of what she called the dark ages, which is when she was throwing herself downstairs whilst pregnant, cutting herself with various implements, suffering from this eating disorder, bulimia nervosa, suffering from postnatal depression, and kind of a cascade of jealousy about Camilla Parker Bowles. That had leached out of her soul, out of her head, and she was making sense of her life. She was going, actually, when she was speaking to me, she was going forwards. She could see some light at the end of the tunnel. So, you know, people have said, oh, well, she was, you know, she was unstable and so on. I don't believe that for a second. She was actually, she was in the early days, she was, you know, totally out of control, but she was regaining control of her life incrementally, not totally, but incrementally. And the book helped her to gain a degree of control over her life.
Although she obviously was still a very vulnerable person, and perhaps that was her nature, as demonstrated by what you were just telling us about the anecdote with the hairdresser being able to take control of her life.
Yeah, but she was also, quite frankly, reckless. I mean, you know, to unburden herself to me, a relative stranger, even though we'd kind of met at cocktail parties over the years, was a remarkably reckless and chancy thing to do. I mean, on day one, I could have just written a story saying, this is what Diana said to me, you know, goodbye.
Mm. But you convinced her, and Dr. James Colthurst convinced her to make these recordings, these recordings via cassette, and that you never met, because what she needed when the book was to be published was plausible deniability, that she could say that she'd never spoken to you for the book.
Absolutely. She wanted to be able to look Prince Philip or the Queen in the eye and say, I never met Andrew Morton, which was actually true. What she had done was answer the questions which I'd posed for her, which were made into these tapes. And people go on about the tapes as being the central aspect of the book. They're of certainly a substantial element, but they're not the only element, because Diana was on the telephone all the time to James. We were dealing with some of her the day-to-day issues, and more than that, I was talking to some of her friends who gave a very different perspective, a more considered perspective about her life, her school days, her childhood, and so on.
And so at the darkest, I was rereading your book. I was just very surprised at the timing of some of the interactions with Camilla Parker Bowles, and that it's already, the affair between her and Prince Charles was already resumed before the wedding between Charles and Diana.
Well, I have to say, Prince Charles, you know, like him or loathe him, was remarkably insensitive towards his bride-to-be. He insisted on giving a bracelet to Camilla, whom Diana had then realised had been his mistress or girlfriend for some time beforehand. And it was an affectionate nickname that they gave to each other, GNF, Fred and Gladys. So, you know, for a kind of a nervy, on eggs, standing on eggshells, bride to be. I don't think she appreciated that at all. In fact, she considered calling the wedding off. She summoned her sisters, Jane and Sarah, and they said, "Sorry, Dutch, your face is on the tea towels now, so you can't chicken out." So, you know, it's one of those. You know, the soldiers were lining the wedding route. The cake was baked. The flowers were in place. So anyone listening who's ever had second thoughts about getting married, multiply that a billion times when it came to Diana. She went ahead with it, but she had grave doubts.
Her sister Jane offered similar advice later on. She said, "Don't let the side down."
Well, this is it. I mean, there is a kind of a thought process that you know, that you marry and then you have your mistress or your lover. And that was a tradition inside the royal family. And I'm sure that Prince Charles just thought, right, I've got my virgin aristocrat and then off we go and make our separate ways in due course. And I think he never really stopped being a bachelor, to be honest with you. Mm. Because you know, when you actually look at the marriage... They married in 81. She was pregnant fairly early on. And then it was pregnant again with Prince Harry, also undertaking these quite considerable royal engagements, such as the 6-week tour of Australia and New Zealand. So it didn't really leave much for the couple to get to know each other as individuals. There's always something else around. And it wasn't long after Prince Harry was born that Charles has admitted himself. He went back to his girlfriend.
Now, what Diana was facing was being kind of shut out if she made a move, if she upped and left and tried to, I don't know, you suggest that she even thought about moving to Australia with the boys, that would have almost been impossible. So she was looking for another way out of the situation, and perhaps this is where she might well have utilised you to help sort of break a deadlock.
Well, I think it's that she saw the book as her kind of testament, her, you know, her voice to the people, speaking over the head of the mass media, speaking over the head of the palace, speaking directly to who the people that she saw as her people, the general public. And the response she got when the book came out was overwhelming. You know, thousands of people wrote to her, all very positively. Many, many women went, mainly women, by the way, went for help for their own eating disorders. It gave them the courage to face, confront them. And that, for her, was extremely heartening. And I think she made mention of that during her famous Martin Bashir interview on BBC's Panorama.
Which followed the publication of your book, and it was also a kind of paired couple to the interview that Charles eventually gave, those two television appearances. We're talking with Andrew Morton. He's the author of Diana, Her True Story. He's updated it. It's now called In Her Own Words. It's a 25th anniversary edition of the book. Andrew, you've put in the transcripts of tapes that you didn't previously, 69 pages of it. What in that do we learn, do you think? What are the most substantial, salient things that we learn from those tapes?
I tell you what always strikes me is that when I actually read her tapes all the way through, you find that she's got a real sense of her second sight and she talks about deja vu. She talks about incidents such as when she predicted that her father would have a stroke and she expected the phone call. She predicted that Prince Charles's horse, Alibar, would die of a heart attack. It's kind of weird, really. And she also talked about, you know, her biggest dream was to go and spend a weekend in Paris. And as you know, it's kind of almost presaging her future and her death. And when you actually read the whole thing, you do find the hair standing up on the back of your neck.
Oh, how did the tapes? What condition are they in? And what was the process of transcribing them? Because I've read that you've used new technology to make inaudible parts clearer.
Yes. What happened is that James Coltoast didn't take the job, you know, particularly seriously in terms of, I mean, buying new tapes, buying a new tape recorder. He would turn up in the sitting room at Kensington Palace, and he would sit there and he'd munch through a plate of biscuits, drink his tea, and read through the questions. Now, nobody expected Diana to die, so you know, I expected this book to be one of many, you know, explaining her life. And what happened is that James also, as a homeopathic doctor, he would use one of these gadgets that helps with muscle relief and relaxation. And the high-pitched whine of it affected the audibility of some of the things that Diana had to say, much to, I have to say, my annoyance. And so it was a kind of an amateurish, the whole thing was kind of amateurish, but it did seem to work. But we've managed to kind of tease out some of the things. And for example, her mother, her relationship with her mother takes on a more complex depth. I mean, after the wedding, she didn't speak to her for several years. She was so, they had a big falling out. And that is something else.
Mother had let her down by crying so much during the wedding and not kind of holding it together.
Yeah, and that's another thing you find as well, is that she's always falling out with people, and especially in her family. She fell out with her brother, she falls out with her sisters, falls out with the father, falls out with the mother, then she falls back in with them. So you never. So it's a very unusual family. There's a very destructive dynamic at play there.
Now, Andrew Morton, as I alluded to earlier, this republication hasn't been without criticism. And some people say that you're raking over old coals. And we know that you and the publisher have made an awful lot of money out of the first edition, and perhaps you may well out of this one as well. But also that Diana's voice from beyond the grave is a little bit unfair on the boys, on William and Harry. What do you say to that?
Well, it seems to me perfectly legitimate as a publishing exercise, and when a book has been in print for 25 years, to refresh it. I mean, the book ended, was 150 pages in 1992. It ended in 1992. So it seems to me very straightforward on the 25th anniversary to bring it up to date, to explain what happened, you know, with her death and then the aftermath and her legacy. And you know, people talk about the boys. Well, they're not boys; they're young men, and also they've lived through all this. They don't need me. They don't need to read any books about their mother or their father. They know them far more intimately in a more instinctive way than you are or I ever could. So, you know, Diana herself wanted this book published. The book has been published for 25 years, and it's now being revised. And it just seems to me a very straightforward exercise. I mean, and as I said at the top of the programme, I mean, her death is being memorialised in at least 16 television and radio documentaries.
What do you think her legacy will be seen as in 10, 20, 50 years from now? Will she kind of take a different shape and place, or do you think we pretty much can see what she will be?
Well, I think that her legacy obviously lives on in William and Harry, and they've made that perfectly clear that they're going to do that. In fact, they're rededicating her grave at Althorpe. And I find it very interesting that they are her living legacy. But at the same time, during her lifetime, Diana was articulating a different kind of vision for the monarchy, And that's what you might call a welfare monarchy, where the royal family get involved in charities. They don't get involved in politics. They don't get involved in civic affairs, but they put their shoulders to the wheels of deserving and often unpopular causes, such as mental health with William and Harry, and with Diana, of course, with AIDS. So the monarchy itself was reshaping, and that Diana gave it an international, cosmopolitan, inclusive feel in a way that it probably, you could argue, it didn't really have before.
Yeah, it does seem like many of the kind of changes that she made are now very much evident in the new generations that we're seeing coming through. And Kate Middleton, too, is playing a very interesting role in that. What do you make of her sometimes mirroring of Diana? She's wearing Diana's engagement ring when she came out of the hospital with George, I think it was. She wore a dress that was very reminiscent of the one that Diana herself wore when she walked out of that same hospital with William.
Yeah, and obviously on the engagement day, it was very similar. I think the huge difference is that Prince William is determined to protect his bride from from paparazzi photographers, from attacks, and so on. And the old idea of the old royal motto, never complain, never explain, which has been largely Prince Charles's attitude to the media, has been jettisoned by Prince William. And he's obviously making sure that Catherine has been inducted into the royal family in a way that, he could see that his mother wasn't, and that she is. She's, first of all, she's a lot older, more mature, and she and Prince William were able to spend years getting to know each other as both girlfriend, boyfriend, but also companions and supporters in a way that was totally absent from the Charles and Diana romance. I think they saw each other 20 odd times before they got married.
Just finally, Andrew Morton, as you know, the Republican issue is always one that's on the back burner in Australia. We had a vote a while back and the answer was no, but possibly because of the way the question was framed, who knows. Do you think England might be a republic before Australia might ever be? What do you think of sentiment in your country towards the royals Elizabeth?
I've always said it's not the monarchy that will be kicked out by the people. It'll be the monarchy themselves that decide they don't want to do it anymore. And Prince Harry's made that perfectly clear. And so we could have a situation where both Harry and William decide, now we've had enough of this. So you go play amongst yourselves. I think that what will happen with the monarchy generally is that it will become more European, in the sense that it will not be you stay in the job until you die. You stay on the job until you decide to retire and you abdicate, because abdication in Europe is not the dirty word that it is in Britain because of the whole fury around Edward VIII. As for Australia, I mean, you never know. The links may tighten, certainly in terms of trade, between Britain and Australia now that we're out of Europe.
Well, that's certainly what Theresa May's government would like. Well, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, as in the sad days after Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II passes on, I guess that's when we'll really start to see maybe a shift in the sentiment.
Well, I think that the traditional argument is, why don't you jump a generation, forget about Charles and Camilla, and then go straight to William and Catherine. I don't think, quite frankly, Prince William would thank you for that.
No. Heavy is the head that wears the crown. Andrew Indeed. Morton, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
That was Andrew Morton talking to us about the revised anniversary edition, 25 years, in fact, since he published Diana, Her True Story. He's done it again. It's called Her True Story in Her Own Words.